I think we got it going. So, how about start by stating your name and kind of where you grew up and when you grew up and kind of how that, how being an American kind of played into that part of you growing up.
Okay. Well, my name is Bob Redig. I grew up in first part of my childhood, I grew up in the city of Cleveland up till the time I was about 6 years old. And then my parents moved to the suburbs where it was an extremely rural community. And very small town. Most of the people that I went to school with, well, I wouldn't say most, but a lot of the people I went to school with in grade school, I ended up going to school with them in high school as well. And some of them went to different middle schools than I did, but we ended up together in high school. And when I was in high school, it was a different time, obviously, than today. When I was, I think I was a junior, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. And for roughly 10 days, we were convinced that there was going to be a war with the Russians over Cuba. And everybody was very afraid and concerned, because that was at the beginning of the Cold War. And the Russians were like the big bad beast from the East. And but we always felt that, at least most of my friends and people that I knew, felt that the United States was the best country in the world by far. And we acted accordingly. And when the Cuban Missile Crisis went away, shortly thereafter, the Vietnam, at that time it was just a small skirmish. We had advisors over there, but it started to escalate. And by the time I was in college in 1965, President Johnson had committed 500,000 troops in Vietnam to fight the war over there. And when I graduated from college, I had an obligation in the military, 4-year obligation, and everybody had an obligation back then. You either went in voluntarily, or you were likely to get drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Most people did, unless you had some sort of a deferment. So we all knew that it was just a matter of time till you had to go, unless you had a physical problem that kept you out of the military, or you had some sort of a deferment, like a lot of people went into teaching and such. Mm-hmm. To avoid the draft. So that was kind of this status of the mood of the country during the, I will call them the key moments in my growing up, when that had the biggest impression on me, was the two military conflicts, the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Vietnam War.
Class.
And we were,
Bob, he's talking. Honey, ice cream and fruit.
Yeah.
Excuse me, ice cream and fruit.
Yeah.
Okay.
On the table.
And so, anyhow, those events dominated most of my childhood. In fact, even in elementary school, The beginning of when I first started in elementary school, there was the Korean War was going on. It ended, I think, 52, if I'm not mistaken. So it was just a short time growing up, but I do remember it and remember the attitude and the mood of the people at that time. And that had a big impact on my life. And patriotism, for me at least, was the pride in our country, knowing that it was, in my opinion and the opinion of most people I knew, the greatest country in the world. And that, you know, we would do whatever it took to stand behind the country and go to war, whatever it was. And it's hard for me to contrast that to what's going on today, because it's a different time. People aren't, there's no draft, so there's no imminent threat of anybody being drafted or going into the military unless they wanted to, because it's all volunteer forces now. And so today, while people thought in my day that it was the greatest country in the world, the United States, that is, I'm not so sure that a lot of young people feel that way. And I can only go by what I read and what I see. I don't have firsthand experience from that. But I don't think that it's being taught that way in the public schools, at least, any longer. I think that there are more alternative reasons for either liking or disliking this country. And I think there's a lot of people that don't necessarily like the country, don't necessarily think it's the greatest country in the world. And that, I think, has a big impact on how people act and behave.
Mm-hmm. So when you were growing up, it seemed as if a lot of people were going to be going to war. Was that kind of a way of showing, a way of showing your patriotism and your pride?
Well, yeah, there were, of course, people that volunteered, but even those that didn't volunteer knew that they were going to be drafted at some point. Even if there wasn't a war going on, they had a draft, and people had to spend at least 2 years in the Army. So it's hard. I don't know if I can separate patriotism from the knowledge that, you know, it was an obligation that you had to fulfill.
But at the same time, I know a lot of people, I feel like a lot of people have that same viewpoint that you did, because I remember in the late 80s when Carter actually, he didn't exonerate, but he let all the draft dodgers come back from Canada free of charge. It wasn't a popular opinion, because I'm assuming from what you've told me that, you know, back in that day, people really took pride in their country and they were really patriotic, and, you know, growing to war was either something you volunteered for or as they saw it as a duty to your country. So somebody that dodged the draft was, you know, scum. Why would you do that? You know, this is the country you live in. Why wouldn't you defend it? So it seems as if that falling in line with that patriotism is living up to the obligation and, you know, fighting for your country. Now, we were talking about how people nowadays might see it differently. And I understand that a lot of people see eye to eye in a different way. So maybe, I mean, obviously you have your opinion that patriotism is something that, you know, you think America is the greatest country in the world, as do I, for me to say. I really do think it is. But maybe someone who does love America, but not for that reason, what purpose do you think that could serve? Or what way could someone, you know, it's like you love your kids, but you also love your dog too, but it's in a different way.
Yeah.
So you think people love America in a different way?
Well, yeah, and I think part of the problem is that back, I don't know when it started, but let me just say probably sometime in the 1980s, that's just kind of an educated guess. People prior to that came to this country because they wanted to be Americans. they came to assimilate into our society.
Mm.
And to them, it was a very, it was a big event when they came into this country legally and did whatever it took to become an American citizen. Mm. And they went and got sworn in as citizens. I mean, that was a huge event because that was a dream of people to come here and be an American. And they, the first thing they wanted to do is learn the language if they didn't know it. Today, I see a different attitude among some, particularly as it relates to immigration. And I think that, and this, that has been going on now since probably back in the 80s, although it's kind of hard to identify a point of demarcation between one attitude and another. But I think it was around then that people started, you know, coming, deciding they wanted to come here just to take advantage of the benefits that the company, the country had to offer. Not so much that they wanted to adopt our culture, but they wanted to adopt, they wanted to take advantage of the benefits.
Yeah, all the stuff that comes.
And they wanted to come here and keep their old culture intact and their old language, which is fine. You know, it's nice to be bilingual and trilingual, whatever. But when you're living in a country that you love and you want to be assimilated into their culture, you, your number one language typically would be English.
Yeah, or at least you wouldn't be able to speak it just to be able to get ahead.
Exactly.
I mean, you're not going to be able to impress somebody if you can't even speak their language.
Yep.
When everyone speaks English, it's going to be kind of hard to, you know, show that you're driven or a really hard worker. You can only get you so far if you don't speak English.
Exactly.
So it's, yeah, that is, it's always strange when that comes about. It's, it seems like it's common sense that you'd want to learn the language of the country you go to. I feel like any other country you go to, you would, you go there like, hey, I'm just going to speak English. I expect you to give me everything, and I expect you to give me all your benefits and be able to get ahead in life, and they're going to laugh at you.
Well, I lived in Germany for 2 years when I was in the Army, and I spent a year in Vietnam, and we traveled to different countries. We were in France, and none of those countries would I have gone over there and started speaking English and expected them to either understand what I was saying or go get an interpreter for me.
Mm-hmm.
You go there to be part of their society for however long. Maybe you're only, you know, you're only going to be there a couple of years because that's how long a tour of duty is in the military. But you learn to at least speak enough English to get by, or enough German, or enough enough French, or whatever it is, to get by, so that people realize you appreciate and have respect for their nationality and their culture and their history and all that stuff. Because, I mean, think about it. That's, other countries have pride in their country as well.
Absolutely.
And so why wouldn't, I know they didn't bend over backwards for us to, I mean, they helped us, don't get me wrong. The Germans in particular, they would try to help you if you were having struggling with the language.
Mm-hmm.
But not the French, they were kind of arrogant, but that's pretty much French for you. But my point is that you you want to learn the language for, you should want to learn the language for more than a number of reasons, one of which, of course, is because you want to be successful. If you're going to live there, how are you going to be successful if you can't speak the language?
Yeah. So I think maybe we've been seeing some of the negative effects of how it is now, but maybe we can touch on some of the things that haven't changed or some things that maybe that have improved in, you know, patriotism or immigration laws in America. Something that, you know, has really had a good transition that you've been able to see throughout your life.
Well, I think one of the things that the all-volunteer military force has done is it's given birth to real patriots in the military. And by that I mean most people, since it is a volunteer force, they don't go in there unless they really want to be there.
Yeah.
And I see guys that are, have been in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, and they're as patriotic as anybody that I ever grew up with.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're really, you know, very gung-ho, and they're there for the right reasons. But unfortunately, there's less people in that position than there was when I was growing up because of the fact that we all had to serve in some way, shape, or form. In fact, if you couldn't serve in the military, you could go into the Peace Corps for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
That was an option to the military. And so there, everybody, even though you didn't carry a rifle, you could serve your country in a lot of different ways. I don't see that because of the smallness of the military in comparison to what we had when I was growing up. There aren't as many people that are exposed to that type of environment that the military brings. So I think that's the people that are patriotic today are every bit as patriotic as anybody that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
There just aren't as many of them.
Yeah, but I think, like you said, or at least from what I could tell, maybe if you're drafted, you'd be kind of mad. Maybe you would kind of lose that sense of pride in your country if you're something, especially if that's something that you're against, even. Maybe you're against the war. I feel like it definitely divided people, and if you're forced to do something you don't like, you're not going to like it even more. So maybe in this situation where someone who, this is something, you know, you have kids growing up, they know they want to be a Marine, and they know they want to be in the Navy, so they have the option to do it, and I think that makes it even better, that you have the option to, and kids actually get to grow up thinking that they can make a career out of it, and it can be their lifestyle, and a lot of people do find success in the military
mm-hmm.
simply for the fact that they got to choose it, and they really loved it.
I would agree with that, but you'd be surprised. When I was in Germany, my first assignment, I had a number of people working for me, and I had a section at one point where I had about 7 or 8 people that worked for me, and 3 of them had PhDs. And 2 of them had master's degrees. And if anybody could be resentful, it would have been them.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't. They were just like everybody else.
They
took their job, they did it, and they did it well because they were obviously intelligent people.
Mm-hmm.
And they griped like all
GIs
do. I mean, that just goes with the territory. But they weren't resentful. A number of people who were conscientious objectors and went to Canada and mm-hmm. other parts of the world to avoid the draft. And there were people who just outright hated the military.
Mm-hmm.
But you have people like that today, even the ones that have never been in the military.
Yeah.
So I don't think, I understand your proposition there, that, but I don't think it was quite as bad as what you may believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what you're saying is if people are forced to do something they don't want to do.
Yeah.
But the degree that they didn't want to do it wasn't to the extent that they would do anything to get out of the military,
like
run to Canada or someplace mm-hmm. else. They just didn't want to go. And, you know, frankly, in a war situation, not many people do.
Yeah.
But you do what you have to do in a lot of cases. So I think that the draft, people just accepted it for the most part. They knew they had to do it.
Yeah.
It was in effect from, I don't remember, as far back as I can remember. I think during the 1950s, the start of the Korean War, and then we had a period of peace there before Vietnam started up. I think the draft was in effect most of the time. I don't think they were drafting as many people in the late 50s because there wasn't anything going on then. But once the 60s started up, the draft really heated up again. So I think that the draft kind of had a somewhat of a mitigating effect on people because it was just inevitable. They knew they were going to go, and
mm-hmm.
they made the best of it.
Yeah. That's that's the only thing you really can do at that point.
Yeah. Unless you want to take your chances and run away and
yeah.
get thrown in jail for deserting.
Now, I have heard something. I heard a really interesting viewpoint about a year ago from a professor. He was talking about Vietnam versus World War II. And his argument was that in Vietnam, morale was a lot lower and the military tactics were actually less efficient because there was no pure objective. Now, to compare, for people who will be listening, you have Vietnam where you go for, what, a year and a half, 2 years?
1 year at a time.
Yeah, you go 1 year at a time. When you're done, you go home.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if you win. Doesn't matter if you get this insurgent. As long as you make it to that year, you go home. So your goal is to go home. Now, if you compare it to World War II, you have Hitler taking over the world. If you lose, then there's no world for you to go back to.
Yep.
So your goal is to win the war, and then you go home. You had people fighting for 4 to 5 years, and their goal was to kill Hitler, pretty much.
Yep.
So it was a lot more efficient, morale was a lot higher, and it was all over just a cleaner war, if for lack of better terms.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. The World War II was a much more clearly defined war with objectives to win, and we did everything within our power as a nation to win.
Mm-hmm.
Not just us, but England was, you know, they were very close to being taken over by the Germans. Could have gone either way. France, of course, was taken over, and all the, you know, Poland was taken over. So we knew, or we didn't, I mean, I wasn't mm-hmm. there at the time, but I've read about it. Our nation knew that we had to win that war. There was no turning back.
Yeah.
We had to win it. If we didn't win it, we were going to be all speaking German today, or maybe Japanese, too. But so that was a different thing, and patriotism was probably at an all-time high at that time because there was so much at stake.
Yeah.
Now, you go to Vietnam, and you're absolutely right. We got over there, and that was the start, not the start, but the escalation of warfare, which was pretty much dictated by politicians. And the rules of engagement were very, very oppressive, much like they were in this country for Iraq and Afghanistan when we first went over there.
No napalm, no...
Yeah, and it was just very, very bad because you didn't know who the enemy was. A little kid might, 10, 12-year-old kid might be sidling up to you during the day and begging for food and chocolate and cigarettes, and then at night he'll bring a claymore or mine alongside your tent and blow you up because you didn't know who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And people that worked in the military, in the American military places like the Officers Club, the NCO Club, the PX, whatever it was, they might be workers during the day in Viet Cong at night.
Yeah.
And that happened quite frequently. So people became somewhat negative, Americans, because they didn't know...
What are you fighting for?
Yeah, what are we here for? In fact, I remember when I got home, they had a thing on television, and they showed the place where I was stationed, that where they must have had 15,000 people there in the heyday. It was like a ghost town. The doors on the buildings didn't have locks on them, and they were blowing in the wind. You could see them. And I looked at that and I said, my God, what did I do for a year of my life?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was frustrating and it was demoralizing, but we went nonetheless because, it was part of what we had to do.
Yeah.
Today, I don't know if that's, I think it would probably be different because We do have an all-volunteer force. But we did have a similar situation at the end of the Iraq War between the transition between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. We had taken over a bunch of cities in Iraq, and they had either ignored it or, for whatever reason, they allowed the Taliban and the enemy forces to take over these towns again. And so that's when Bush implemented the surge to retake these towns. And in the process of doing that, we lost several people, but it did take it back and morale increased, and we were in a pretty good position at the end of that. But they had no plan for getting out of the war. They had a great plan for getting in and winning.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got captured Saddam Hussein and took over all of Iraq, they really didn't know what to do next.
Yeah, they didn't plan to.
And so they didn't want to be a nation builder. At least that was what they said going in. But they were almost put in a position to have to do that.
Oh, yeah. Because otherwise you just give the terrorists the rubble and tell them to build it up.
Because once Hussein was in, once he was dethroned, it was open territory on Iraq. And Iran came in there and the terrorists came in there. And they took control of a lot of the territory. That's why we had to do the surge, because we just didn't know how to handle it. And that was probably the biggest problem with that operation, other than putting aside the fact whether we should have even gone into Iraq at all.
Mm-hmm.
That's another argument or another question to determine the answer to. But as far as how we handled ourselves once we got there, it wasn't one of our better moments.
Really, really annoying.
Well, I think we definitely did get to touch on some topics. I did, like I said, I definitely wanted to see how patriotism kind of went from your viewpoint growing up to where it is now. And I think it's always like to hope that it's on the way up. It's unfortunate that there are some people, some dissenters at least, that now with the internet are able to kind of gather together and influence some other people and be a lot louder maybe than what they actually are. But I think the reason why I chose this, because like I had said before, I really do love this country, and I think that it is the best country. And I just wanted to see kind of how someone who had grown up in the quote-unquote heyday of patriotism, how they would view it now. So I think I got some really good insight on that.
Well, I hope that was helpful. I just, I feel like when this country was founded, it was founded in turmoil, but it was planned turmoil by people who really wanted freedom. I mean, that's really the bottom line.
Yep.
That was what our whole Declaration of Independence and the Constitution was based upon. I mean, the laws and everything were part of it, but freedom was the end goal. They wanted freedom from the tyranny of the English church and the king, and they achieved that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful, challenging country, a place to live in at the time. All the opportunity that anybody could want if you wanted to go out and take it. And we've kind of changed that over the years because of the various political and social arguments and positions that come along. But I think you're right. I think there's hope that there's enough young people that feel the patriotism that I think a lot more people may have felt back in my day. Although, I looked at it from a very small perspective.
You definitely surround yourself with people.
You don't know if that's true or not, but that's the way I felt growing up, and I think there's probably a lot of truth to it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I really do appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. Hope it helped.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good